TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Cows and the American West. Welfare Ranching.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. On a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged sky and up a cloudy draw.
One of the strongest symbols in music and film, even internationally, is the American cowboy. He stands for virility, independence, and freedom. And by extension, beef was and is the quintessential American food. And the myth continues, even though modern-day ranchers are not lone strong fellows, but more often corporations, such as Disney or Anheuser-Busch. Even though the enormous and still rising consumption of beef has led to an unparalleled health crisis, the cowboy myth prevails. Behind the public mythology, there's a hidden dimension of the love of cowboys that is never talked about. What is the cost of grazing cattle in the western states of the U.S.? Environmentalists talk about the West because, unlike in some states east of the Mississippi, where it takes 2 acres a year to graze a cow and calf, in the arid West, it takes 14 acres per month. The area of land, most of it public land, that is leased out for grazing to ranchers in the West is simply staggering. It is 300 million acres of land, equal in size to 3 Californias. And the ranchers do not pay nearly enough for the use of public land and nothing at all for the environmental devastation caused by grazing. Cattle grazing is subsidized by the taxpayer at $500 million per year. Cows, though benign-looking, wreak havoc on the land they graze on. They destroy and pollute rivers and springs. They devastate plants and tree life. And they compete out local species of animals by either destroying their habitat or giving them diseases. And much of this destruction occurs out of our sight and experience. Biologists claim that the impact by cattle is larger even than that of deforestation and mining. But we do not see it because it is more subtle. It has affected millions of acres for a longer time, often since the 1800s. And dramatic changes over long periods now look normal to us. There's an interesting project underway to end abusive livestock grazing on the nation's public lands. The National Public Lands Grazing Campaign is working on legislation to buy out the grazing permits and to return millions of acres of public lands and hundreds of miles of rivers to wildlife. This radio program is dedicated to their work. You will hear first from George Werthner, a wildlife biologist and botanist. He has done research and hiked much of the overgrazed areas throughout the western states and documented what he found over time. He brought a number of slides to his lecture and describes them well enough so you can experience his passionate attention to detail. Here is George Werthner.
Grazing is so ubiquitous, it happens on most of the private lands and most of the public lands in the West. 90% of the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, lands are grazed, at least for grazing. 69% of the Forest Service lands are leased for grazing, and they'd be more except that some places are so dense with trees that they don't graze them. Even some of the National Wildlife Refuge lands as well as National Park lands are grazed. So we have very few places without livestock grazing as controls. So we don't have very many places where people can go and see what an ungrazed place looks like. Even things like wildlife refuges, the only thing you see in the background is cattle. And this is a national park, Grand Teton National Park, where grazing still occurs. And these do not happen without effects. For example, in Grand Teton National Park, a couple years ago, they killed a grizzly bear in the national park because it had killed a cow being grazed in the park. And you say to yourself, well, what is a park for? Is the park have, is it, at least in my view, the park is set aside for things like grizzly bears. And yet the way it gets managed when you have livestock is that becomes the priority thing. Now, I mentioned earlier that most of the breeds of cattle that are used in the West are slow moving, and of course we've made them worse by breeding them to be fat and so forth, so they're not very mobile. And they also like being near places that are sort of wet because they evolved in moist woodlands in Eurasia, and that's the kind of habitat that they seek out. And in the West, most of this kind of habitat tends to be the stream bottoms and what are called the riparian areas, and that's the green belt that's affected by water. So cattle hang out in these areas because, one, there's green vegetation to eat. In fact, in a lot of parts of the West, like 70-80% of the forage that you'll find on a grazing allotment will be associated with riparian areas. And in addition to that, of course, there's water that they can get, and often shade, too, if there's trees. So our riparian areas in the West, which support 75 to 80% of all wildlife species, are also the very places that livestock tend to congregate and have had serious effects. For example, Sheldon Wildlife Refuge in Nevada, and this area used to be a wet meadow, and now it's a sagebrush-filled place because of downcutting. The stream channel has cut down, and eventually the roots of the willows and other species that used to be found here couldn't reach the water table and then disappeared and sagebrush invaded. And this is a very common sight in a lot of parts of the Great Basin and other areas of the West. This used to be a wet meadow with aspen and beaver. It was an old beaver dam in the sagebrush. When this stream, which has been grazed for well over 100 years, goes into an enclosure, a place that hasn't been grazed because it's been fenced. In the ungrazed parts of the streams that are like that, you have far more trout and they tend to be bigger. Well, having more trout and bigger trout has other implications besides how it affects fishermen. Animals that depend on fish are affected. So if you have less fish and they're not as big, you have less river otter, you have less mink, you have less food for things like bald eagles and osprey or anything else that's dependent on fish. It's not just the fish that are affected, of course. There's all sorts of other aquatic animals and vertebrates and invertebrates that are affected. Now, the effect on riparian areas can also have other impact. Now, we're looking upstream at this area that's grazed. There's no willows hardly at all down here, and there's just big cottonwood trees. There's no young cottonwood trees. And then I'm going to turn around and show you this side of the fence looking downstream, which has been fenced from grazing for 7 years. And this is what the same stream looks like. It's gotten much narrower. It has all sorts of young trees and older trees growing up on the edge of the banks. Has much more shade and bank stability. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, I visited the same site. And I went there, and these trees are much bigger now. And there is all sorts of logs and stuff caught and jammed in here. It's stabilizing the stream banks as a result of the bigger trees that are growing there that are now acting as little blocks on the water flow. And lots of studies have shown that, like the San Pedro River, for example, in Arizona, which is very close to this area, they closed off to grazing in 1984, and they've shown, you know, like 200% increase in migratory songbird nesting in that area as a result of the vegetation changes resulting from the elimination of livestock. Now, another effect that's happened is in a lot of parts of the, particularly the Southwest, we've lost a lot of these large trees, and because they're you know, they die and they get knocked over by the stream or whatever. And in many places of the Southwest, they're not being replaced because the young trees all get eaten, the saplings and seedlings get eaten by livestock, so that the bigger trees are not being replaced. And these big trees are important for all sorts of things. Not only do they, you know, act as debris that protects stream channels and provide fish habitat when they fall in the stream, but they also, while they're existing, they're important for nesting habitat for things like bald eagles, or, and this is one of those kind of things that you never think about, red bats in the Southwest roost in the bark under the larger cottonwood trees. So red bats are in decline in the Southwest, partly because of the loss of the old cottonwood trees, which aren't being replaced. So when you talk about, you know, you wouldn't think about bats being impacted by livestock production, but in fact, it has those kinds of repercussions through the ecosystem. I just saw a study that was done on New Mexico, which analyzed the bird species for New Mexico that were listed as endangered or threatened. And there were 91% of the species on that list, livestock production was involved. 91% of the bird species. And largely because a lot of them are real dependent on that riparian habitat. Now, here's another thing that you don't think about. We're trained, because we have this thing to look at bucolic landscapes in a favorable light, to look at something like this and say, oh, isn't that nice, nice green field out there in the desert? But of course, irrigation, besides the cattle being using the water in the stream, we take a lot of water out of streams in the West to grow hay and alfalfa. And these hay and alfalfa fields have all sorts of impacts. Of course, the dewatering stream's one, which I'll address in a minute, but even the fact that you've eliminated the native vegetation and replaced it with this exotic vegetation, that has fragmented and eliminated native plant communities, which of course subsequent impacts on all sorts of wildlife as a result. And it's a pretty significant amount of land. In Montana, where I used to live, for example, looking at aerial photographs and looking at different vegetation types, so it's very accurate. They can tell down to a 30 by 30 meter square area what the habitat or land use is. And 5.5 million acres in Montana are used for hay fields alone. 5.5 million acres. Now, to give you a perspective on that, the amount of land that's urbanized and developed in Montana is 0.17%. In other words, 1/5 of 1% of Montana is highways, malls, and housing tracts. And 5.5 million acres, which is about 6% of Montana, is in hay fields. This has negative impacts. So I want you to, when you see these hayfields, or even here in California, drive up the Central Valley from Sacramento to Redding, and what you're going to see on most sides of the highway, besides rice paddies, is going to be hayfields. And it goes for miles and miles and hundreds of miles. Well, in all these western states, the single greatest use of water is for irrigation, not for public use, and that includes in California. But like, let's look at Nevada, the driest state in the nation. 90% of all the water in the state goes for irrigation. And Nevada produces the same amount of beef as Vermont. Hardly, a major beef producer, yet we've sacrificed most of Nevada's landscape because almost all the public lands are leased for livestock grazing and well as most of the private land. Using scarce water to grow livestock feed. And it's not like California where some of the irrigation, you know, grows lettuce or something else. We're talking about almost 100% of the water use in Nevada is for hay. In Montana, 97.5% of all the water used in the state goes for agriculture. And again, in Montana, what do we grow there? It's cold. We grow mostly hay. And so that has serious consequences on streams. Dewatering streams, and also wetlands. A lot of the wetlands in California, Oregon, and so forth that were drained to grow alfalfa. You've heard of the big issue with the Klamath Basin on the Oregon-California border. Most of that Klamath Basin farmland was created by draining former wetlands and to grow crops like alfalfa and hay, fed to livestock, and with serious consequences for waterfowl. The other consequence of course, the irrigation use is that we dam rivers, and the damming of rivers fragments these aquatic ecosystems, just like housing tracts will fragment habitat here on a slope in, you know, the sides of the mountains here near San Francisco or something. And the fragmentation, it can be several things. One, you can't have things don't move up and down anymore of the river, and that affects species like migrating salmon and so forth. And also the water changes because the water is colder or it doesn't flood anymore. There are various changes in the water quality and quantity that affect a lot of aquatic vertebrates as a result of dams. And most of the dams in the West, even though they're justified for hydroelectric or recreation, oh, we're going to go run motorboats on it or whatever, they wouldn't be built in the first place, if it wasn't for the motivation to provide storage for for irrigation. And so, as I mentioned, this affects things like spawning salmon in the Pacific Northwest, and here in California is another good example where salmon have been affected by that, like on the Upper Sacramento River. And other species in other parts of the West have been negatively impacted because of those changes in water quality. Now, it's not just streams directly that are tapped into. You also have groundwater pumping. And this is an old historic photograph of a place called the Bruno Hot Springs, which when I used to work for the BLM in Idaho, I actually went here a couple of times because there's some rare plants that are found here. And there's also a rare snail that grows in these hot springs and downstream from this hot spring. And this is what it looked like in 1920. And this is what it looked like in 1984, 85. Maybe it was 1990, but it was somewhere in there. It was many years later from the 1920s, and that waterfall is gone. There's no water left in the hot spring, and there's only one other spring that now the Bruno Hot Spring snail is found in, which is drying up because in the 1960s they started groundwater pumping, which is dropping the water table, which is affecting the snails in this area. And that same thing has happened all over the West. For example, Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge near Reno, which has many different endangered species, pupfish, various mollusks, and so forth, which is now a wildlife refuge, but originally that area was threatened by irrigation drawdowns for agriculture. This is another way that water and cattle affect things. A lot of the springs, I'm talking about cold springs, and seeps in the West, which are also very important for all sorts of animals. For example, all kinds of endemic snails in the West that have very limited distribution that are often associated with just very small drainages or a few springs and so forth. But there's frogs, there's birds and so forth that depend on these springs. And when they get developed like this for watering livestock, there's no vegetation around it, cover. They become places that a lot of wildlife won't use anymore, or they use and they become population sinks. Now, if you're a small mammal or a rodent or a bird, ground nesting bird, and or an amphibian, that's not good habitat left for you. And a lot of places in the West, I saw one survey that was done of the Owyhee Canyon country where I used to live, actually, used to work for the BLM. There are like 3,000 seeps and springs there that are developed for livestock production. Almost every single spring has this kind of impact on it. So there are very few that are left in a natural condition. Well, there's one other effect of having cattle being attracted to these water things is they poop. And since they spend so much time near these waterways, they're also the major source of water pollution in the West, non-point water pollution. Okay, so that's impacts on water. Many, many ways that livestock protection affects water and the wildlife and water qualities associated with that. Then there's soils. In a lot of the West, in fact, it's true even in the East, but it's not as noticeable. There's what they call these biocrusts. And these biocrusts live in the on the soil surface and have a number of functions. One, they prevent soil erosion they have these little like filaments that embed among the soil particles that hold it together. And on top of that, they fix nitrogen from the air and put it down into the soil. And they also have a unique thing in that they prevent weedy annual species from establishing in a lot of cases, because you got to know a little bit about the ecology of plants and grasses particularly, but perennial grasses tend to have larger seeds, and annual grasses tend to have smaller seeds, because the annual grasses are sort of opportunistic, going where they can. They got to get down quickly. Their roots, and because they don't have, they grow and only have one season to accumulate energy, they don't tend to be very big. Well, in a place where you have a lot of biocrust, the annual grasses or other annual plants do not have enough biomass in their seeds to get roots down into the soil very deep before they die, dry up or whatever. And so where you have a lot of these biocrusts, there tend to be less of annual establishment. Whereas the perennial grasses, which were native to a lot of the western part of the United States, have bigger seeds, and they will sit on the surface here, and if there's a crack because of frost or whatever, they have enough energy in their seed to get down through that. So what it does is it tends to favor the perennials, the native species, over the annuals. Well, when you have the cattle come in here, or sheep as the case may be, and they trample all these biocrusts, well, then you favor the annuals. And that's happened a lot of places in the West where we have invasion of cheatgrass, for example, partly facilitated by the cheatgrass and annual, partly facilitated by the presence of livestock and their hooves trampling. Well, another effect is just soil erosion, and one of the major causes of soil erosion, particularly on public lands around the West, is livestock production. You go on a lot of places, you'll see this pedestaling of plants and so forth where sheet erosion has gradually washed away the topsoil. And even if it's only a half an inch or an inch, since it takes hundreds of years for that soil to accumulate and build, that's it's like mining these lands. Another effect of livestock production, you have the animals out there, these domestic animals carry disease that are detrimental to native wildlife. So you have like bighorn sheep in the West, and a lot of places are no longer found because they get disease from domestic sheep that has killed off the herds. And a lot of places we can't reintroduce the bighorn sheep because of the presence of domestic livestock. In fact, I just read about in Montana, where I used to live, one Forest Service agency just signed an agreement with some of the sheep ranchers that graze on our public land to allow the owner of the sheep to shoot bighorn sheep on site that come near their herds. And the reason they signed this agreement is that the Fish and Game in Montana wanted to reintroduce some bighorn sheep in this one mountain range, which is grazed by domestic livestock. And so the guys that own the sheep there said, well, the only way we're going to go with this is if you let us kill any sheep that come near our sheep. You know, just the fact that they had that kind of power to me is disturbing. But the fact is that there were actually two other mountain ranges that the Fish and Game wanted to reintroduce the bighorn in because they were better habitat than the one they finally did reintroduce them. And the reason they didn't is because the rancher said, well, we're not going to let you do it there. And this is on our public land. This all goes behind the scenes that you don't know about. And I even saw this when I worked for the BLM. I'll tell you one story. I remember one of the first things I had to do was help designate what were called Areas of Critical Environmental Concern, ACECs. And I went out for the day, well, actually a week, and I surveyed this inventory of this area. I came back in, I drew my maps and so forth. I submitted to my boss. And this area was a canyon with uplands that had never been grazed, benches that had never been grazed, beautiful blue bunch wheatgrass, grasslands, and then a beautiful riparian area. In the riparian area, the cattle couldn't get into because there were waterfalls upstream and downstream for about 2 miles. So this riparian bottom was in really good shape. And I drew the map to include the uplands, too. And I handed it to my boss, and he calls me into his office a couple days later, and he says, you did a great job on this inventory. This is, you got all the good attributes, and this really makes sense to set this aside. But I altered your map slightly, and he shows it to me, and he says, I drew the lines right here at the canyon rim. And I said, well, but you got all these bunch of grasses up above that have never been grazed. It's a great place to have as a control that we can look at. He said, yeah, but if the ranchers see that there's a bunch of grasses there, they're not going to approve of this. And I said, but they can't graze it now. There's no water there. He said, but they're going to think someday we might get water there, and then we'll be able to graze it. And so they're not going to approve this. And if they don't approve it, the state director won't sign off on this, so you won't get it. So we then changed the boundaries to fit the canyon thing, and that's what we sent out for public comment, us, the biologists, with our idea of what was the best thing for this landscape, already compromised before it even got out for public comment by that influence. Now we got predator control. As you know, in a lot of the West, coyotes and other animals are trapped regularly, all the time, even though there's a lot of studies that show that even predator control doesn't do any good in the end because, well, partly, this is another one of those stories about lack of controls. There's only two places where there isn't significant predator control, Yellowstone Park and the Hanford Energy Site in Washington. And in both places there, coyotes act a lot like wolves. They form territories. They live a long time. They produce very few young. In places where you exploit them, where they're trapped, shot, and poisoned, they produce a lot of young, and they're inexperienced, so they tend to be much more likely, actually, to take livestock. So it's a self-defeating purpose. But nevertheless, we kill thousands, tens of thousands of coyotes every year, satisfy the livestock industry. And we also kill wolves. We're trying to reintroduce wolves in many places in the West. And the Yellowstone area is an area I worked in for a long time. And every wolf pack whose territory overlaps largely with livestock has been either killed or controlled, removed in some way. They don't survive for more than a few years at most. And the only place we're going to have wolves constantly without management constant interference is going to be in the few places that don't have livestock. So if you want to have wolves in more than just a few token national parks, and wolves are an important evolutionary force. You want to restore them in a lot of places, not just because they're wolves, just because it's nice to think that there's wolves there, but because of the predation by a large animal like this is important to many species. We need to restore that evolutionary process, just like in a lot of places we need to restore fire. Another thing is what they call pest control. Prairie dogs have been just devastated throughout the Great Plains and elsewhere where they're found. There's five species of prairie dogs in the West, but the largest one is black-tailed prairie dog, but all of them have suffered. And black-tailed prairie dogs and others have been poisoned because ranchers consider them competition. And this has had negative impacts on all sorts of other species, about 148 species that are known to be dependent on prairie dog towns. So when you eliminate prairie dog towns, you affect things like black-footed ferrets, you affect things like burrowing owls, and they are all negatively on the decline too. Black-footed ferret is listed, the burrowing owl may soon be listed, and mountain plover is another listed species that's dependent on prairie dog towns. So pest control is another thing that happens as a result of livestock production. Then there's social displacement. I mean, in a lot of places, a lot of species, elk is one in particular that's been well studied, elk will not graze in the same place with cattle if they can help it. If they have any choice, they will move to another place. Now, they might come in there after the cattle have left, but they will not be there at the same time, so they're displaced. And, you know, animals don't just go, I mean, they're using the best habitat. They're in a place because they think and they know or whatever that that is the best habitat. So if they get displaced out of that, they're going into less suitable habitat, more marginal habitat, which affects their overall, you know, ability to survive. And then there's nutrient cycling. When a bison or an elk dies, that feeds coyotes, it feeds ravens, it feeds in Yellowstone, it feeds wolverine and other scavengers. This is truncated or lost on many public lands because of the dominance of livestock, which gets most of that forage.
You heard the first part of an hour-long program that calls attention to the destruction of the public lands of the American West by cattle grazing. The speaker was George Werthner, a wildlife biologist and botanist. He is the co-editor of a large documentary book called Welfare Ranching, the Subsidized Destruction of the American West. In the second half of the program, you will hear about a plan to restore the grazed lands by retiring the grazing permits. You can find more information on cows and the American West on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get a one-hour tape or CD of the program on Welfare Ranching, Cows and the American West by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 1-877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.